Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hey there, Investment Voice listener. As you know, we frequently highlight and showcase EB5 news from around the world, sometimes focusing on specific issues, sometimes focusing on specific legislation, but oftentimes focusing on specific countries and markets. And today is no different. It's been a couple of months since we've had an update on the Chinese EB5 market. But Mona, I am to understand that there's new news to share today.
You know, Mark, this is such a dynamic industry.
Right?
And with a market like China, which has been traditionally the most active of all markets, not just for EB5, but for global CBI as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're looking at big regional centers picking up hundreds of investors at a time. There's always something or another going on. Today, we have David Herson to talk to me about some amazing news that is being imparted to us by Sam Udani.
Welcome back to the show, Sam Udani. And we also have joining us again, David Herson. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be here again and look forward to sharing some of the information I've gleaned.
David, this market suffered a lot after being hit by the long visa backlogs in 2017. And for the longest time, it really felt like this market was not coming back. But post-RIA and the new set-asides, we have seen a lot of action.
Absolutely. Different countries. China's not up to the numbers they were for our own office filings, but we understand and we'll hear more from Sam on that.
Then back in mid-August, the industry was just stunned with the arrest of the CEO of one of the largest migration agencies out there. Do you recall, David?
Oh, yes. I was in China shortly after that, and it was quite an impacting event. There were five of them, I believe, arrested. The four, other than the chief, was allowed to go. And I'm not quite sure what the fate of the chief is. Last I heard, she was still in custody.
Ah, and there is where we have some news. Sam Udani, you've got the latest out of China, right?
Yes. I've come back from China just a couple of weeks ago, and I'm headed back again at the end of this week. I'm in and out of China all the time, and obviously focusing only on the EB5 industry while I'm there. I do pick up a lot of information about what's going on. So we have some confirmed news. We have some rumors, as there always are in situations like this. And there's also effects in terms of what has this done to the industry. So,
well, Sam, I know David had really thought, and David, we quoted you in one of our articles, that after this arrest, you thought the market was going to slow down.
Yeah, that is correct. And I felt it did some in terms of talking with other agencies who were really tightening up their own situations for fear of a similar reaction by the Chinese government to them as was done to the first agency.
So, Sam, is that what you're seeing?
Well, in terms of volume, I'm utterly not seeing any kind of slowdown whatsoever, which is a bit to my surprise, because I thought that the same thing that David thought, you know, that there would be a slowdown in the market. And I think most people thought the same, because that seems to make common sense. But let me tell you about what solid confirmed news we have from China. And I think that helps us understand a bit about what's going on before we get into the rumors and the effects.
Yeah, that makes sense, Sam. Walk us through it.
First of all, the charges. I mean, these charges have been disclosed in a couple of semi-official news media, so we can take them to the bank, as it were. And the charges relate to money transfer transactions done back in 2016. None of the charges have to do with anything that happened in 2022 or 23.
Interesting.
Right. So that's the first point. So that's very, very clear. And again, to kind of confirm what David is saying, to the best of my knowledge, as of a few weeks ago, I talked to an agent in person in China who said, look, if she was out of prison, I would know about it. And as of right now, she is in prison. We are referring to the CEO of Hualien, which is, by every account, for the last 10 years or more, one of the largest migration agencies in China, as Mona said. Now, that part is confirmed. Now, the other part that was a bit of a surprise, we have been, of course, in touch with the Big Five. We call them the Big Five Migration Agencies of China on a regular basis. And we have good correspondence with them and communication with them, both of by our team in China as well as our teams elsewhere in the world, including the U.S. And we were surprised to see that it was a little bit slow going in terms of how the folks at Hualien were responding to us. It was a bit slow, a bit cold. And then last week, we heard from them in writing saying that they're no longer involved in EB5.
You mean Linda He is not involved, the CEO, or Hualien?
No. Hualien as an agency, of which Linda He was the CEO at the time of her arrest.
Right.
Hualien as a migration agency is absolutely not involved in EB5, is what they told us in writing. So we went to their website, hualienvisa.com, and anyone can check it. And they've had that website for any number of years, more than a decade. And sure enough, they're doing all kinds of CBI. Many countries, the usual suspects are well represented, but not the United States. And if you look at the United States services they offer, they do offer them EB1As and IWs, EB1Cs and others, but not EB5s. So they're not out of America and they're not out of CBI, but they are out of EB5. And that's the confirmed news we have out of China.
Is that just Hualien, or are you seeing any other of the big air players exiting EB5?
They are very much hungrily, as best as I can tell, trying to grab Hualien's market share.
Yeah, because Hualien had brought in many, many investors over the years.
Thousands.
Yeah.
Thousands.
Yeah.
No question.
The rumor about the offense being related to foreign exchange contraventions is the same rumor I've heard for quite some months now. And the fact that it wasn't specifically EB5. Our experience with some of the bigger agents, and there's one particular one we work with, which I feel inappropriate to name, is that they are doing EB5. They've been very cautious. They've cleaned up their act on anything that the government may not like. So what I'm finding generally is that people are trying to be in full compliance with the government's requirements so that they can carry on doing the EB5 business that they were doing before.
Well, that's interesting. That's two different parts there, David. One is the rumors, and the other one is the refers to one of the effects. So let me address both of them, because you touched upon both, sir. It's not a rumor that the charges relate to money transfer. That's, as I said, confirmed through two semi-official media in China. So I think we can count that as confirmed news. The rumor is as follows, and you know, I don't know if it's true. I'm just telling you what I've picked up in China. What they've said to me is that was not the real cause for her being charged with offenses and being imprisoned. That was simply the charges that, you know, prosecutors will often, as we all know, even in the United States, use whatever they can get once they decide that someone has to be targeted, and something which makes it easier for them to stick in terms of what evidence they have with them. Now, the terms of the license that all the migration agents used to have, it's no longer true anymore, but the terms of the license are that it comes from the Entry Exit Administration of the Ministry of Public Security in the People's Republic of China. And therefore, they are bound by the terms of the license to confirm to such instructions as the Entry Exit Administration may send their way from time to time. The rumor I heard was that she was specifically instructed not to assist a specific individual in exiting China. And she went ahead despite that instruction. And her punishment, such as it is, follows from that. And to the extent that they are no longer involved in EB5, I believe is a way for, you know, Hualien to want to continue business despite what has happened, and perhaps for a way for her to be released on bail, regardless of what happens to the ultimate charges. Now, the other part, what David, you just talked about, which is the cleaning up their act and conforming to the laws of the government of China, refers to fund transfers. And you are absolutely correct. I am seeing exactly that. I'm seeing that the agents are telling investors and each other that, look, we have a license and we are happy to help people through the immigration process. We're happy to do source of funds. We're happy to put different projects in front of the investors. But we're not really licensed to do, you know, fund transfers. That's not what we do. And we stay out of it. We'll just document the source of funds once you've got everything ready. And in that sense, of course, I think David is correct. The other effect, which completely surprised me, which I was not expecting, was that the agents in China, a large number of them, by no means all of them, are moving away from WeChat into WhatsApp.
Oh, that's interesting. WeChat was the communication tool.
Now, that I've known for quite some time, and that is because all of WeChat's information is maintained in central government's records. So there are some of my clients, I say, are you sure you want to be on WeChat? They say, I have nothing to say that the government can't listen to, and we carry on WeChat. Others have moved to WhatsApp, and there are six or so others that people are choosing randomly through the system. But on what Sam's point about the exchange control, we have the other side of it, and that is the U.S. side of that, where the U.S. government, in its infinite wisdom, has decided to become the police of other countries' exchange control. And they are insisting on full compliance in those countries for the transfer of funds. And that's a major blockage, because you used to be able to take your suitcase of money, give it to a person, show your money was clean, arrives on the other side, that person shows their money is clean, and in it comes to the U.S. Now the U.S. government's requiring licenses from both those money transfer organizations if they are businesses. And there aren't such licenses, I don't believe, in Vietnam, and certainly I don't believe in China. These are left to the banks. So the next step is to try and find a bank that is able and willing and can legally comply, so we can overcome the other side of the coin, which is the USCIS issue that is very strongly exercised and has been for quite some time now.
Well, David, also, if USCIS is overstepping here, I'm pretty sure we're going to hear about some kind of litigation going on.
Well, I thought of that, and I thought of this. If I'm a judge and USCIS comes up to me and says, we don't want money that's not properly authorized to come through to this country, we're required to follow the lawful source and path of funds, we will not back off. I don't see a judge saying, yeah, back off. Do something that you know would possibly be illegal in another country. I don't think it's a winning case. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, and also RIA does actually help them, because RIA is there saying that you can't take loans out, and it also transfers to any of these kind of path of funds, which might circumvent the laws. So yes, I see your point. One of the biggest effects of this, David, from what I can see, and I'm sure Sam is going to agree, is that this is going to mean that there's a lot less people coming out of China, even though we do have the visas for them right now in the set-aside categories.
Well, I mean, regardless of what dampening effects might exist in reality, what also exists in reality is a massive explosion of demand in China. And both these realities are playing together. And that is often the case in markets where you have conflicting trends and they both coexist at the same time. But nevertheless, there is a net effect between those trends. Once you add it all up, you have a final direction as to which the market is moving, and a kind of a momentum by which it is moving in that direction. And there is no doubt that the market is moving up, and is moving up quickly. And there is absolutely no doubt about that. So despite this dampener, as best as I see, China is going up, up, and away. What is dampening is something completely different. And Mona, I would like to talk about it. There have been severe losses in China in terms of projects going belly up in the United States, and hundreds of investors in many individual projects. So hundreds in each project being left high and dry. They may have had their I-526 and I-829s in hand, but no money, $0 in hand. And that is causing earthquakes in China. So Mona, there's some things which I saw about that, which I think will interest your audience.
Absolutely. And I do know a little bit of this, so it is quite scintillating. Go ahead, please, Sam.
Yeah. So what has happened is that the historical view in China has been that if they stay with the big players, the top five, the top 10, the top 20 regional centers in the United States, the top 20 developers, the top 20 issuers of securities, then, you know, they would be shielded, or the kind of losses that other projects might experience would not be repeated amongst the bigger players. That has been the impression in China and the firm belief in China, and their investments have followed this firm belief. And what experience has shown is that that is not true. Some of the largest players in this field, in the top five, have had huge bankruptcies, each bankruptcy affecting hundreds of Chinese investors. And that has really shaken up the market. I'll just mention two quick anecdotes, 20 seconds each on that. One is that one of the biggest agents, no, he's actually the biggest agent for one of the biggest players in the United States in the EB-5 industry. He told me that he personally brought in 65 investors to one project. Every one of them lost money. At some point after the pandemic, they had to get everyone together in a meeting when it was permissible to do so in China under the pandemic rules, and tried to explain what had happened as best as they could. And he said that the pressure he felt from the people in the room, while he did not feel in any which way physically threatened, when he was talking to me face to face, he put his hand over his heart and he said, I had to go to a hospital and I had to have surgery right away. The poor man had a heart attack.
Wow.
I mean, this is a seasoned professional. He's been in the EB-5 industry more than 10 years. And this poor man had a heart attack because of the word he used was pressure. I mentioned that he did not feel in any which way physically threatened by all the investors. Now, I can tell you, I've been talking to an agent in China three times in this year so far. Three times I've been in person to their office. And the lady who runs the show there told me, look, I like, you know, going forward with EB-5. I've tried to tell my people to do it. My salespeople have all listened to you. They like you very much. They understand what you're saying, but they completely refuse to sell EB-5. And I said, why? And she said, well, they are afraid about their own physical security, their own physical safety. They believe that if one of the investors loses money a few years down the road, they think they're going to be physically attacked. So it's a big problem. And I think, as best as I could see from evidence I saw in meeting dozens and dozens and dozens of agents in person, in their own offices in China, in the last couple of months.
What I was thinking, though, Sam, is that what makes this a little different from the rest of the world is that in China, most of the investors really relied on the agents. There's so many instances, and David, I'm sure you can also say the same, where we have no contact whatsoever with the person. It's only with the agent. So when there's so much reliance with the agent, is this not inevitable?
Well, I would say I hear you. I think your point is entirely accurate. But only thing I would add to it is that it's not just true for China. It is true, I believe, as best as I know, for Korea and Taiwan.
Again, reliance on agents.
Exactly, exactly.
Wherever there's a language barrier and there's those issues, there's a reliance on agents. I think this is the case. David, are you seeing the same? Are you hearing the same?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I've even got one example which I feel I don't want to quote names, but the salespeople in the field would take blank forms to these investors who never knew what their investment was until the problem arose, and then they found out they were in A, B, or C project. That's how bad it got.
We saw an explosion from China where they were taking advantage of the set-asides recently, and especially for the rural rural projects. No?
Well, we have data now on that. And what we can say is that there wasn't as much, let me put it this way, there wasn't as much of an explosion. What happened was that the AIIA filed a Freedom of Information Act request, to which the USCIS and the Department of State did not respond, as usual. And they had to be sued. And then they eventually, I believe, got a hold of a redacted 526E filings from April 2022 to April 2023. And they have analyzed them and classified them and put them together on some very, very beautiful tables for the industry to look at and try to draw conclusions from. And what that clearly shows, the big, big, big news, which I think hit me immediately when I saw it, was that the total quantity in dollar terms of investment in that 12-month period was roughly the same as the total quantity of investment that came in to the industry in the calendar year 2019, which is when we had the last big rush.
That was a very significant year because that was a big, big rush that year.
That's the way we all remember it, don't we? And my point is that there used to be years before that in 2013, 14, 15, 16, which were not just two times higher, not three times higher, but four times higher, and perhaps even as much as five times higher than 2019. The big problem that the industry, I think, always knew and was that, you know, when you raise the investment amount from 500 to 800,000, is that going to hurt total demand, total dollars coming into America, total jobs created in America?
In fact, Sam, we just had a podcast, Mark, didn't we, on the psychology of investing at 500,000.
We did.
And how the experts are saying it does take a year or a year and a half before an investor doesn't feel sort of hard done that he's going from 500 to 800.
And the interesting part is that the data shows clearly that it has, the investors have not blinked. It's very clear from the data. And what that means is kudos to Congress. They pulled it off. They did the right thing. They came up with a number that works. We've gotten more, and this is just, the market is just getting started. I mean, this number is going to be doubled in the coming 12 months, as best as I can see, and perhaps will go up even further in the year after that, despite the fact that, of course, there will be, you know, cutoff dates imposed by the State Department at some point. So I think that the explosion, whatever we saw so far, was small as compared to what has happened after April and what will be coming in the months to come.
But Congress wanted a rural swing. I'm not sure that we are seeing that. David?
Yes, well, people, mainly from China, they got the order through the WeChat command that says go for rural only. And we have big discussions with people, go for rural or go for TEA. My sense is that they're going to even out in some way because there's such a demand for rural that TEA will sort of balance out, even although they're 50% of the visas available. That said, I also want to comment on one issue. My observation is, although the money might have been the same in 2019 as it was in this study, remember that because the money per investor is higher, there were far less investors. So if you're counting cases, there are much less cases than there were during that time.
Yes. You are 100% correct, and that's material to immigration attorneys. But as far as developers go, as far as national policies go, David, as far as creating jobs, this is the jobs program. And as far as that goes, it is something that I think Congress deserves kudos for. But in terms of helping as many immigrants as possible, I think your point is absolutely well taken. There are fewer immigrants so far. I think it's going to get better. But from the data, so far, fewer immigrants. You're quite correct, sir.
Well, my sense when I was in China was that there is a tremendous demand by Chinese nationals who do want to do the investment, and the blockage is all political or regulatory because they can't get the money out.
Absolutely. That is the biggest single kind of a roadblock in causing an even bigger explosion. I agree with you, sir.
Sam, are you seeing that there is an issue relating to perhaps real estate, that there isn't such an appetite for real estate the way there used to be?
Well, it's more an issue. That's a very interesting observation, Mona. It's not much of a demand issue. Your point is correct, but it's not as much of a demand issue as it is of a supply issue. Let me explain. I think David's point about rural is entirely well taken, and I think is certainly true in the market. People do get the point that 2,000 in the statute is double that of 1,000 in the statute in terms of the number of visas available to rural versus HOA. So definitely people look at rural twice as hard as they would look at HOA's projects, just on that score. The problem with rural, the problem that people are having, not in terms of demand by investors, because they, as I think, Mona, you rightly observed, are being steered by the agents and are counting on the agents to steer them correctly. But it's mostly because the agents are really struggling with the different asset classes that constitute major investment opportunities in rural America. We are seeing asset classes which have been traditionally almost completely absent in EB-5. We're seeing agriculture. I'm talking about projects currently in the market,
yeah.
Agricultural projects, oil and gas projects. Multiple of them are in the market.
Oh, yes. Solar, energy, all of these things.
Right. Manufacturing. We're seeing several manufacturing companies in the market. And mines. Believe it or not. There are mining companies in the market.
We did have several mining projects back in the day, like I would say around about 2013, 2014. There were some at that point. We had a project up in Alaska, which was a mine, but it just didn't take off just because real estate took over.
Yes. So that's the big question, because on the one hand, so we have two kind of competing trends, right? On the one hand, we have David's point, which is that, and he's absolutely correct observation, that the market is moving towards rural. On the other hand, the countervailing trend is that there isn't a whole lot of rural real estate of the kind that folks in EB-5 are accustomed to. So they've got to figure out which other asset classes make sense. And ultimately, only the market will tell. I do not think there is any answer to this question as of now, and perhaps there won't be for another 6 months or a year. Real estate, my suspicion, is will remain the king of the roost, but the question is, by what margin? Will real estate be like it used to be, 85% of the market or more, 90%? Is it going to be down to 75%, 65%, 55%? We just don't know. We're going to have to learn.
Well, then there's an additional factor for rural that people are feeling is very important, and that is the accelerated adjudication required by Congress. Now, the practicality of that is still to be seen. On the other hand, we have several expedite projects that are TEA, not rural, and those are being adjudicated quite quickly, and that's become the attraction as well. So although you're in TEA, the benefit you are trying to achieve with the accelerated adjudication doesn't necessarily follow. The best one I've got, of course, is one that is rural and has national interest to it, so it's being accelerated from two sides. And let's see what happens with that. I'll tell you about it in a couple of months. It's just got to USCIS this week.
Oh, good. But gentlemen, I know that we've discussed the problems with PATHA funds. Are we seeing a higher net worth of individuals now that it's at 800? Because I thought that a lot of Chinese lost money post-COVID.
I would say in terms of Indian investors, yes. In terms of Chinese investors, no.
Good observation. I think I agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So, risk mitigation.
Yes, this is something that is absolutely top of the mind for the agents, because as I mentioned to you earlier, the quantity of investor losses of projects going belly up, completely unexpected projects with nine-figure, 10-figure balance sheets going belly up after having full construction completed, successfully sold, you know, various assets which were constructed. Despite all of that, things have gone very, very sideways for a number of projects, and that has caused heartburns in China. Now, therefore, they are now trying to say, well, how then, if size is not a way, if just going to the top players in America, if size is not the way to secure the safety of the investments for our investors, then what is the way? I have some ideas there, because I've had spirited discussions with dozens and dozens and dozens. We're talking well over 50 agents in China, 50 different agencies in more than half a dozen different cities about this issue. Many times those discussions just on risk mitigation alone lasted over an hour. And I came with certain, with a back and forth, these are all done in good faith on both sides. And I've come up with some ways in which we can explain to them what the issues are. And I think it is making some headway now in China.
But Sam, I noticed one thing. And David, I'm sure you could opine here. We're not seeing the big regional centers monopolizing the way they used to. There is a tendency now to move out to other projects, smaller, maybe unknown projects who just rented a regional center.
Seeing some of that, but there's still the big guys who've had no losses and have repaid billions of dollars are still an attraction. I just want to address the litigation issue. I get some feedback from some litigating firms in China, and the litigation is not only by these investors against the regional center and all the people involved, they're also turning on their agents. So the agents become defendants in those lawsuits. I don't know if Sam heard the same or saw the same.
Well, what I did see was that out of the five big agencies in China, four of them had their own securities lawyers who directly they had on retainer in the United States. And absolutely, I do think that that is happening, though obviously they were not particularly keen to talk about it.
Okay. Well, let's get back to some of the issues that are happening in China. Sam, could you walk us through them?
So the first issue is a very common sense one. Let's say me or David were to go down to Shanghai or Beijing and try to buy a bicycle distribution company or a restaurant, you know, or any kind of business. It's a very, very, very difficult thing to do for any one of us in America to say that we can go to a foreign country, you know, spend a couple of days and pick up a business and make the right decision is not something that's possible for most of us. It's not impossible if we had plenty of time and, you know, we had business savvy and we spent time in that country, tried to understand all the issues with a specific business, tried to make a judgment on whether that business would be successful or not before making an investment. But it's a very, very difficult task unless we were prepared to invest months and months and months of time. Which, of course, is not the case for most agents evaluating most projects in the United States. So judging American businesses for success is a very difficult endeavor. So how do you mitigate risk in that context? And that's where something which is unique to America and completely foreign to not only China, but even India comes into play. What I had a conversation with them, I said, look, what's the problem if the project goes belly up? And their point was, well, how will our investors get their money back? I say, how about you turn that question on its head? Try to get your secure your investors' money. Even if the project goes belly up, your investors should be made whole or nearly whole. And there are ways to do that. And they said, really?
Yeah, really? But Sam, yeah. This is not a new concept. This is, getting collateral outside for perhaps a loan as opposed to preferred equity has been going around for a long time.
No. There's a deeper issue. The deeper issue, many, many people, as you're right, they've been doing it exactly. Yeah. The part that really struck a chord was not this. As you're right, this is well known. The part that struck a chord is when I told them that, look, India and China have been successfully running societies for a very long time. They're the two oldest cultures on the planet, and they have 5,000 plus years of a successful society behind each. So they have something going for them. And guess what? The rule of the law is not such a big deal for those societies. They run through other principles, not like they don't have law. Manusmriti in, for example, the India dates back thousands of years. But the point is that it is very, very different from the United States, which is, you know, much younger civilization. The Western civilization is only 2,500 years old. But the rule of the law is at its foundation. The West cannot conceive of running a society and a country without the rule of the law. So this principle of difference in cultures and their foundations and the importance of rule of law to the West, what does it mean to EB-5 and to securing investors' monies? That became apparent to the agents when I said something which was very simple to me, but it really blew their minds. And I said, the bankruptcy courts of the United States are three things: fast, fair, and clean. They're fast, they can resolve most issues with real estate projects which have gone sideways in a few months. They're fair.
But I think here's the issue. Most of the world does not understand what a Chapter 11 bankruptcy is, because most of the world only have a Chapter 7 bankruptcy where everything is liquidated. And the word bankruptcy just denotes fear and loss and all of that stuff. But a Chapter 11 bankruptcy in the United States often gives investors money or a certain part of their money back, because, of course, you have somebody coming in and stepping in and restructuring and looking to see where they can grab money. And I think that information is not out there.
No. It wasn't quite as nuanced as that. Let me tell you what reaction I got. Even in Chapter 7 bankruptcies, in almost every case, there are some assets to distribute and there are some funds available. The question is who gets them. Even in Chapter 7 bankruptcies, in real estate in particular, there are hard assets which have value. And there have been many Chapter 7 bankruptcies in real estate, nothing to do with EB-5 in general, but the real issue is our bankruptcy courts. They're fast. So the bankruptcy courts in the United States are fast, they're fair, they will implement the contracts fairly, and they're clean. You cannot bribe anyone. Now, when I told this, which is common sense to all of us in the United States, it came across as a thunderbolt to the agents in China. Their point was that, look, if anything goes wrong with any business that we invest in China here, we're finished. If the business doesn't succeed, no one will ever see a dime except the people who run the business, and they'll run away with the money. There's no chance in hell we're going to get anything through any court. That is what all of them told me unanimously, dozens of them. Okay. And when I told them that, look, it's a matter of the contract. If there is a, if there are people at different positions, first position, second position, third position. If you are in first position, historically in real estate projects, 80 to 90% of your funds will come back to you. That is the track record.
Well, outside of bankruptcy, of course, there are cases, and there's been recent cases where investors, groups of Chinese investors have sued and they have got some money back. Not necessarily all, but they have got some. And David, I don't know if you feel the same, but the more that this happens, because the Chinese were not so litigious before, but they are now, but the more it happens, the more it's going to happen.
Yeah, I think there are certain attorneys in this country who are stirring up the litigation. They're seeing profits from it, even if they know they probably will not get any money out of it. Some of these bankruptcies were fair deal failures, so there's no fraud or dishonesty. I saw one litigation. I advised one of the attorneys, don't litigate this one. I worked with them, and I know how squeaky clean they were and how their records were. I heard along the grapevine that they did file litigation. They lost the case, and a collection attorney was given the millions of dollars of legal fees to collect from the investors who failed in their case. There's always the danger side of losing those cases, and I think they are pitched by the people trying to make money from the cases more strongly than they should be without warning. Another example I had was where there was a bankruptcy. It was an unfortunate bad business situation, and the jobs had been created. The company didn't want to have anything to do with it, and the bankruptcy courts, as you said, are very swift. They want to get rid of it, close the file. So we arranged to buy the NCE and gather the records from the JCEs. There were several of them. And we now sit with these records, and as these individuals come up for their I-829s, we've got the paperwork ready to file their I-829s, managing that corporate shell, which is the former NCE. So there are some very creative things that can be done to help people at least get the green cards, even if they don't get their money.
Well, kudos to you, David. No question that if you were able to help people with that method, that's fantastic. And litigation is something that I'm sure is one arrow in the quiver. The part that sunk in terms of risk mitigation was the idea of first position. Almost all the agents I talked to did not understand that there are different positions when things go wrong.
And Sam, it's, as I mentioned earlier, this is such a dynamic industry. And unfortunately, we are losing some of the big players. And as you mentioned on the last time when you spoke about China, it's all about a lot of new people coming on. So I do see a lot of education needed moving forward. But, you know, that's what we're here for.
Very good. You're absolutely right, Mona.
Mona, thank you again for inviting me to the podcast. I always enjoy these podcasts. But I want to especially thank Sam for bringing his fountain of valuable information to the table and helping bring so much current stuff to everyone. Sam, thank you.
You're welcome, David. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on any forum with you, sir.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.